A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
What are you doing, detective? What are you doing talking to my client without me present? You sneaky Pete.
Lose! I don't lose! I win! I win! I'm a lawyer! That's my job! That's what I do!
Okay, everybody, this is Alex Barnett for Comedians of Law. I'm joined in the booth today by Kevin Israel.
What's going on, Alex? How are we doing?
I'm good. This is episode 51 of the Comedians of Law podcast, or as we like to call it, Return of the Jedi, again for the third time.
I don't even know what that means.
I don't know. I was sort of trying to wax lyrical, and I got stuck in the middle. But
we'll edit that out.
Yeah. In any event, we're happy to be here. We've got a lot of big things going on. We've got shows coming up all throughout September and into October. Comedians of Law are going to be very busy. We're going to be at Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco October 4th.
Yeah, that should be awesome.
We're going to be doing a show with our own Joan Weisblatt on October 9th.
In Jersey at the Stress Factory?
That's right. And then October 29th, I believe, we're going to be with the New Jersey Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts at an event, at their annual event. So that's very exciting. And then we've got our own performance schedules going on.
And if you're listening to this and you're in law school or you are involved in a law school somehow and you want to bring us to your school, you can always book us. You can go to comediansatlaw.com and book us directly. See us live. This doesn't have to be just a internet relationship.
That's right. That's right. Although we appreciate your listenership, Kevin's right. We would definitely like to come to your school, or your bar association, or your law firm.
Yeah. And I've had some solely internet relationships, and it never works out well. So let's make this more personal.
That's right. That's right. We're not the Craigslist of comedy. We're live.
No.
Well, Kev, let's get right into the news because I know you've got a couple of stories you're really excited to talk about. So here we go with the news.
But since when has the paragon of investigative journalism allowed lawyers to determine the news content?
So, Kev, the first story, well, let's get right into it. You sent me a story about the Olympics, the 2020
yes.
Olympics. So let's get into what's going on here.
Well, as you may know, and as the listeners may know, the wrestling was banned from the Olympics for reasons that seem to elude many sports fans. Wrestling was actually one of the original events in the Olympics. Greco-Roman wrestling is, I mean, one of the basic sports that the Olympics was founded on. And it was removed, but much to the content of wrestling fans everywhere, and this is real wrestling, not Hulk Hogan wrestling, it's going to be back reinstated in the 2020 Olympics. So if you're a wrestling fan, if you're a fan of watching men in singlets roll around on the ground with each other, you'll get to see it in 2020.
Now, let me tell you something. I'm excited about this because, as I told you before we went on air, I was a high school wrestler. And I wore a singlet and I rolled around on the ground. So,
do we have any video of that?
No. When I was in high school, it was before the era of video.
Right. Do you have any stone tablet carvings?
Yeah, there might be some cave drawings, I think. So I'm glad to hear that wrestling's back. Wrestling never got the credit it deserved. I just think that of all the sports they have, tiddlywinks and synchronized swimming, you know, wrestling belongs right there. It's an obscure sport that has no professional league. Why not?
Well, it's not one of the most exciting sports to watch. It's very technical. I'm not taking anything away from wrestlers. Wrestlers are amazing athletes, and it's something that I never had any interest in doing. But it's not the most.
At least not traditional methods. You know, wrestling with women, you certainly.
Right. Listen, if a woman wants to go a few rounds, that's completely different. And I do hold a couple belts in that. So, but as far as collegiate wrestling goes, It's just not, it's not a viewer friendly sport. I don't think it's not very exciting to watch. It's a lot. The moves are very fine. You really have to know what's going on, and it's not exciting. There's no people's elbow. There's no splashes from the top rope.
Well, see, you're jaded because you're one of these guys who watches professional wrestling and doesn't realize that it's all theatricality. It's like watching ESPN SportsCenter and then watching a game and saying, "Well, it's so boring. How come there's not highlights every 3 seconds?"
All right, Alex, I don't like you representing to the listeners that I, for some reason, think that the WWE wrestling is real. I understand that it's theatrics. What I'm saying is, watching real wrestling, watching Olympic wrestling, just isn't very exciting.
Well, all right. So should they ban the marathon from the Olympics?
Oh no! What I think this absolutely belongs in the Olympics. This is it's a very competitive sport. It's a very athletic. The wrestlers are amazing athletes. I'm just saying that as far as why there's no professional collegiate wrestling or professional Greco-Roman wrestling leagues is because there wouldn't be any support for it. It's not a TV friendly sport.
Well, okay, I'll go with you on that. But I think, look, the Olympics were designed for sports that no one really wants to watch. That people want to participate, but nobody really wants to watch. That's why we have rowing, we have distance running, we have the crazy track and field things where you're throwing a javelin and a shot put. I mean, who's going to watch that on television?
I ran track and field in high school. I enjoyed it a lot. I was a high jumper and a long jumper.
Right, but those actually might be things that people watch on television, but there wouldn't be a professional. I mean, there is a professional league as such because people get paid to do it, but I don't think there's going to be a league like the New Jersey long jumpers versus the Connecticut high jumpers or something.
But if there was, New Jersey would crush them just because.
I don't agree. I think New Jersey is definitely a state filled with people who eat too much pasta, including your governor.
You attack me for the stereotype of wrestling, but you immediately go after a stereotype suggesting that all New Jerseyans are overweight Italian people.
I didn't say Italian. I just said overweight.
Well, that, come on. The pasta reference, I think we all know what you're saying.
Listen, I just said overweight. In any event, well, look, I think this is fantastic that wrestling's back in action, and I think they should start to – I think they should put other sports in, like competitive comedy.
You know what? That would be interesting to see. We've both taken part in comedy contests. A lot of people probably don't realize that even exists. But I would say competitive comedy is just as physical, if not more, than badminton, which is an Olympic sport.
Yeah, I think that's right. And they could have competitive, and then everyone could say, as a credit, I've been on the Late Show or the Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and I've also been in the 2020 Olympics as a comedian representing my country.
Right. Absolutely. And listen, I just noticed there's table tennis in the Olympics, better known as ping pong. I guess they just don't want to call it ping pong because they need to make it sound official. But if there's table tennis, then I think it would only be right if they included beer pong.
I agree with you. I think America would actually excel. I mean, I think our competition of beer pong would clearly come from like the Central European countries, Germany, Ukraine, Croatia. You know, the big
definitely Germany with their Oktoberfest, I'm sure have pretty much a lock on drinking games. I was quite the beer pong player back in the day. I think I might be able to try out for the U.S. Olympic beer pong team.
Maybe. Although I suspect there's people in this country who are even better at you. I could see you getting on as an alternate, as a sub.
I'd take that. Now tell me, when you were in college or whatever they called it back then with Socrates, did you guys play beer pong?
It was played on my campus. I was not a practitioner of that. I used to play more obscure, erudite games like Drink Trek, which was you would pick a character in Star Trek. We'd all watch, and then whenever your character spoke, you had to drink.
So whoever got Captain Kirk probably lost.
Yeah, if you were Kirk or Spock, you were in for a long night.
That's incredibly sedentary.
We played Drink Trek. We played a lot of High Bob. For those,
a lot of what?
High Bob for people who are older than you. The original Bob Newhart show. It became sort of a thing, like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. So the thing with the Bob Newhart show was every character when they would walk in would say Hi Bob, and so a drinking game has emerged from that called High Bob, which is every time someone says Hi Bob, you drink.
You're so old. You're so old. I think even the listeners who are older than you right now probably shaking their head at how old you make yourself out to be.
Yeah, I'm pretty old.
Was that on color TV?
Well, it was, but check this out. I had a television in those days with an old school remote control that wasn't digital or infrared or whatever technology they use. It was one of those old, like, it would click and the click noise. And in fact, it was so busted up that if you sneezed too loud, the channel would change.
So when people, because some people do call the remote the clicker, you actually had a clicker.
I had a clicker.
Wow.
In any event, let's move on to our next story.
Somehow
this one's crazy. This one's right out of the Sex Files, which is right up your alley.
Yes, this is a strange story, and this actually has a little bit more of a legal spin to it. A man in Missouri was arrested, and then it was later revealed that he had HIV, and he had exposed his current partner and possibly 300 other partners to HIV.
Is this guy a Major League Baseball player or a rock star or something like that?
No, he's just a guy. Just a guy. His name's David Lee Mangum, which I first read as Magnum, and I thought that was kind of ironic that a guy named Magnum had 300 partners, but it's Mangum.
How does he have 300 people who slept with him?
I applaud him.
I don't mean to get hung up on the tangential part of this story, which is, you know, the other part, you know, is the more important part. But like 300 people is a lot of people.
It is a lot of people. And the funny thing is, he says that he didn't tell any of these 300 sexual partners that he had tested positive for HIV in 2003 because he was afraid of rejection, which if you've slept with 300 people, it sounds like rejection really isn't an issue.
Well, anyway, so, regrettably, I mean, not to make the light of this is pretty serious. 300 people might have been exposed to HIV or were exposed potentially and might have contracted it. What's going on with this? Has this guy been arrested? Is he in jail? What's going on?
He has been arrested. This is a crime. Knowingly exposing someone to HIV without their consent is a felony under Missouri law. It can bring up to 15 years in prison. His bail was set at $250,000. This was just last week. Now, I know a lot of states. I know New Jersey does have a law about knowingly exposing somebody to HIV. Does New York, do you know, off the top of your head?
I mean, I don't know, but I would imagine it. I would imagine most states do. I find it amazing that this guy slept with 300 people. Now, was it all men, or excuse me, all women, or did he sleep with men too, or what's going on?
No, I believe he is gay. It says that the police are warning anybody who may have had sex with him through the Craigslist website in the Men Seeking Men section. Listen, I'm not trying to make light of the situation, and I'm not trying to say anybody's asking for anything. But if you're finding casual sex on Craigslist, you might want to use a condom.
Wow. So, but it looks like from what you sent me that he did have sex with women too.
Oh, he did. I didn't notice that. I just noticed that it sounded like he was finding most of his sex from Craigslist on the men. So he's an equal opportunity employer.
I mean, I could be wrong. Maybe I misread it, but this is incredible to me. So, what's the lesson, Kevin, since you're the one who's the most sexually active one, certainly of the people on this podcast?
Well, that's just because you're married and have a kid.
Right.
So, yeah.
I mean, we have sex once every fiscal quarter just so that we can calibrate our calendars here at the house. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it.
I think the takeaway here, number one, is that this is a crime. That if you have sex with somebody who knowingly is HIV positive or has AIDS, they've committed a crime. And it's a serious crime. But I think also the important takeaway is don't get sex on Craigslist. Just don't do it. Folks, if that's where you're going, and I have a feeling most of our listeners are probably not looking to get laid off of Craigslist, but it's a crazy dangerous thing. I mean, it's out there. I guess if you need to have sex that badly, that's an easy way to get it. But you have freak shows like this running around who are so scared of rejection that they forget to tell you, hey, by the way, I'm HIV positive.
Yeah, yeah, very serious stuff, very scary. So we'll be monitoring that. We'll keep people posted on it. Let's move on to this next story, which actually I read about earlier, and you found it again on your own, and I think it's fascinating. This guy wants to have a whites-only town. Unbelievable.
Yeah, a whites-only town. It's out in North Dakota, which I guess if there was going to be somebody looking to have a whites-only town, it would seem out west is probably where that's going to happen. The town of Leith, I think that's probably how it's pronounced,
yeah.
L-E-I-T-H, 70 miles southwest of Bismarck, which is, I guess, the only notable city in North Dakota. This gentleman, Paul Craig Cobb, who is a pretty extreme white supremacist, is buying up all the property, and he's trying to make it an all-white town. And it's just – it's crazy. I think that is crazy. And then the crazier part of the story is that there is one black guy who lives in Leith who doesn't know what to do now.
I think he probably needs to not hang out with this dude who doesn't want him there. But I read a story that said that the people of the town have rallied around this black guy you're talking about and have told him, like, they've sort of circled the wagons around him, said, like, we've got your back, man. We're not going to let this guy ruin our town.
Yeah, and as heartwarming as a story as that sounds, what Alex just said, you need to keep in mind that Leith has an official U.S. Census population of 16 people, possibly as high as 25. So
you're saying about 23 people have the back of this black dude.
I would hope so. I mean, possibly as low as 16. Well, if you're counting him, 15.
Right. Right. Now, do you think that you and I would qualify for membership in this guy's vision of the whites-only town? I mean, we are Jewish, which is a wrinkle.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty big wrinkle. We, as far as I know, I haven't met too many white supremacists, thankfully, but I'm pretty sure that African-Americans and Jews probably run neck and neck on how much they hate us.
Now, are people saying that he's broken any laws?
I don't think as of now he hasn't broken any specific laws. He's just buying property and he's promoting it as an all white town.
Wow. That's amazing. But so, you know, listen, I think that it would be interesting to see what would happen if other people decided to do this. For example, have an all Chinese town called Chinatown, or an all Italian town called like Little Italy. I mean, haven't people done this in the past?
You know what? I think that was more of as a result of immigration at the time. A lot of the areas that are Little Italy or Chinatown, when especially in the urban areas like New York, a lot of this started in New York. When people moved in, they wanted to be in communities of their own people because for language reasons and for just ethnic reasons, they wanted to be around their own people, and they all grouped. I know when Jews moved in, there were Jewish areas, and that's why that exists. Nobody cut out now. Nobody's looking now and going, you know what we need? We need an all Chinese community out in Michigan. I think it's definitely a little different.
Okay, well, I mean, you know, I think that that's probably right. Although it is interesting, though, that ironically, people have done this and it hasn't been an issue, and now a guy wants to make a white. But of course, obviously, with whites, there's a whole idea of exclusion and discrimination and racism behind it.
There's that, and we all learned about it in law school, I think, in property. There's a town in Florida that's owned by, I think Disney owns it. It's called Celebration.
Yeah.
Celebration, Florida. And it's got a lot of weird, creepy rules that seem, I think, run very heavily Christian. And some people say it's a strictly Christian town. So this isn't the first time. To quote Paul Craig Cobb, that name just sounds like he could be a serial killer, but he said that he hoped the plans for Leith would excite white people and give them confidence because we're being deracinated in our own country.
Right.
I'm not a linguist, but I don't know if deracinated is a word.
I actually believe it is a word, but I have to say, you know, I think he's right because, for example, my wife and I are in the process of deracinating the country, even as we speak, by, you know, being a black and white couple with a biracial son. And I hope this guy's not going to be too offended at our efforts. But
yeah, and by the way, then you definitely would not be welcomed in Lee.
That's true. Except by the
other people. Well, you might have a better chance, but the other two-thirds of your family probably would not.
Right. But it points up a bigger issue, which is although this guy's motives are malicious and ill-intentioned, the truth of the matter is that America is becoming a browner country through immigration and through intermarriage. And, in fact, I would think that within the next 100 years, everybody who lives in America will be part black, part Chinese, part Latino, and I'm going to pull for part Jewish, but I know that might be a bit of a stretch.
Well, yeah, well, you know, I do remember when I was in high school, Time Magazine, maybe when I was in college, did the cover of Time Magazine had a picture of what the average American will look like in 30 or 40 years. Maybe it was a little further ahead than that, because of all the, you know, the interracial marrying and the you know, interracial breeding, and that we'd all end up looking like we would have one kind of skin tone that was a little darker. You know, our eyes would be a little more almondy.
Yeah, and I think everyone's going to look like Tiger Woods, a little lighter.
Yes. And listen, if we're all as good golfers, I'll take it.
Yeah, although golf is boring. Golf is very boring. I'm sorry.
I would disagree with that, but you used to sit around and play a drinking game that was based off of Bob Newhart's show. So. I'm not sure you're really the go-to for excitement.
Well, let's leave that there. Let's leave that at there, because we have a big interview on this show, so we got to move to that.
This is a crazy one, huh?
Right. This one is our own Matt Ritter got an interview with a very, very fascinating character, a guy named Sean Hopwood. And check this out, Kev. I don't know how much you knew about him before, but he's a former Nebraska bank robber who was sentenced to 12 years in prison for 5 robberies. While in prison, he started spending time in the law library and then became an accomplished Supreme Court practitioner by the time he left in 2008.
Wait, he's a lawyer?
He's now a lawyer. Now a lawyer and an accomplished one at that.
Is that how boring prison is? It actually makes reading law books sound interesting?
That's right. He got an offer to work as a law clerk for Judge Janice Rogers Brown of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, which is probably the second most influential court in the country after the U.S. Supreme Court. And after a year, after a career as a bank robber, he's now going to, who knows, become a Supreme Court justice later on in his career. So anyway, let's turn to that interview right now.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the podcast. We have a very special guest. I'm really, really excited to hear some of his tales. Hopefully we're about to hear some really incredible stuff. He is a bank robber, former bank robber turned legal clerk and law student. Welcome to the podcast, Sean Hopwood.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
I mean, your story, it's like almost so unbelievable. It's like, I assume they're already making a movie about it.
Well, people are interested in it, but at this point, no, we aren't going forward with a movie yet.
I'm just going to jump right in. Who would play you in the movie? Who would you want to play you in the movie?
I have no idea. Maybe Ben Affleck.
Yeah? What about somebody younger, like Ryan Gosling, right? Because didn't most of the stuff happen in your 20s?
Yeah, that's true. I actually – my wife and I just watched a bank robbery movie with Ryan Gosling in it a few days ago.
Was that Drive? Is that one?
No, The Place. It's Behind the Pines or something like that.
Oh, how was it?
It was okay.
Yeah. So you, all of a sudden, how is it that all of a sudden everybody just sort of stumbled onto your story? I mean, it's obviously not, you know, brand new that all this stuff happened.
No, I think, in February 2010, Adam Liptak at the New York Times wrote a story about me and my legal successes, and that's kind of what jumped off everything, including the opportunity to write a memoir that Random House published and to go to law school and many of those things that happened were a result of that first article. And then he decided he wanted to revisit the topic after I had landed a clerkship with Judge Janice Rogers Brown and after I had an interesting dialogue online with the federal district court judge that sentenced me 14 years ago.
Yeah, let's talk about that because I just read the article on NPR. So let's just back up for a second. So you robbed a couple of banks in the 90s as a young man?
Five of them.
How does a bank rob, like, what was your role? I mean, if you don't mind talking about it, how does that go down? Like, is it like in the movies or is it not as crazy as all that?
Oh, it's pretty crazy. I mean, everything in your body is telling you not to do it, especially when you grew up the way I did. And you know, I knew it was wrong from the beginning. But I was such in a state of desperation. I just had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And I was around a bunch of other people that were at the same point. And you mix in desperation and drug and alcohol addiction and a really confused, stupid kid, and it's a recipe for disaster.
Wow. I mean, did you think you were going to get caught when you were doing it?
Oh, we knew we were going to get caught, or at least I did. I was never under the illusion that we were going to get away with it. And in some ways, when I did actually get caught, it was a relief.
It was a relief just to be done with it.
Just to be done with it.
And so, you know, I read this, you know, you had a pretty big sentence thrown at you.
Yeah, I was sentenced to 12 years and 3 months, which in the federal system you have to do over 85% of the time. So there's no, you get a 12-year sentence and you're eligible for parole in 6 years. And because of that, I spent almost 11 years in federal custody.
What are your feelings now, I mean, towards the judge? It sounds like, you know, you kind of have mixed feelings a little bit.
No, I don't have any hard feelings towards the judge. He sentenced me at a point in time where the U.S. sentencing guidelines were mandatory.
Yeah.
And he actually gave me the lowest sentence he could under the guidelines at the time. And, you know, I had committed some serious crimes and deserved to go away to prison.
Yeah, but I guess I was reading in that area. I guess you know you said something about how, you know, anything over 5 years is a lot. Like, you know, that's sort of like the timeline.
Yeah.
Where I guess you were trying to say you're kind of getting diminishing returns out of sentencing somebody for so long.
Oh yes, I think federal sentences across the board. I think across the nation we send too many people to prison for too long. My individual case, I've never said it was an unjust sentence. What I've said is that if we're really concerned about not just punishment, but punishing the individual and rehabilitating that individual so they're not coming in and out of prison for the rest of their life and costing taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars, then sentences over 5 years are problematic. It's really hard to become rehabilitated or use your time wisely in prison when you're facing a 10 or 20 year sentence.
So
especially when you're in your 20s.
Yeah. How did you do it? What was the thing that, you know, sort of made you turn your life around?
Well, it was a couple of things. One, it was I was fortunate enough to land a job in the prison law library. And once I started legal researching and writing, I found I really enjoyed that. And I really enjoyed helping my fellow prisoners. And also, my wife started writing me in 2000. And I knew if I ever wanted to have a chance with her, because she wasn't my wife at the time.
How did you guys meet?
We're from the same hometown in Nebraska. And we knew each other in high school, but not well. And after I graduated high school, I had not seen her for 8 years. And my mom works for her father, and my mom and Annie became friends, and she heard about what had happened to me and decided to send me a postcard in 2000. And one postcard turned into letters, turned into hundreds of letters and phone calls, and she would occasionally come visit me in the prison in Illinois.
Wow. So you ended up in the library. Did you know that you sort of had an inkling for the law before that or never?
Had no idea. had no idea. I had never studied law, never even thought about becoming a paralegal or a lawyer or going to law school. If you would have asked my friends in high school about the chance of me going to law school, they probably would laugh at you. It just was not something I had ever really thought about.
But so you stumble into it, and then you start petitioning the courts. I mean, and you ended up getting a case heard in front of the Supreme Court?
Yes, that was either the second or third legal brief I had ever prepared. And it was a friend of mine, John Fellers, who was also from Nebraska, had just lost in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals and was begging me to write the petition to the Supreme Court for him. And I was reluctant to do so, mostly because, you know, I knew filing to the U.S. Supreme Court is a different animal from filing habeas motions in district court.
Yeah. But so you ended up filing it, and you won a 9-0 decision.
Yeah, well, you know, the attorney had a little bit to do with that. His name was Seth Waxman, and he was a former United States Solicitor General during the Clinton administration. And I think he's argued more cases in front of the U.S. Supreme Court than maybe but one or two people on the planet. And so, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say I won 9-0.
You were part of the team as a team. Yeah, part of the team. So is that what kept you going? I mean, between your wife and the briefs, is that sort of what your motivation?
Yeah. I mean, that was a big part of it. Part of it was, you know, when I committed the crimes, I was 21, 22, and, you know, I just grew up.
Yeah.
There's lots of stupid, foolish young men out there that make stupid, foolish decisions, and eventually, a lot of them grow up and just grow out of it. You would be shocked at the number of people that have come up to me and said, you know, I did something really bad when I was in my 20s, and I was just lucky enough not to get caught. I'm talking prosecutors have told me that, U.S. Marshals, a lot of people do things and their early 20s that they look back on now and think, wow, how did I ever do something so foolish?
I would say I could chalk myself up as one of those people who was lucky enough to, skate through my 20s.
Yeah.
Some dubious decisions.
Yes.
You know, it happens. And so now you're in law school. You're graduating this year?
I will be in June.
You're clerking. What is your? I mean, do you have a plan for long term with the legal profession, or are you looking to do something non-law with the law degree? Or
no, I really enjoy litigation and I enjoy helping others, and I could see myself in public criminal defense somewhere once I'm done with a clerkship and a possible There's quite a few fellowship opportunities in Washington, D.C. for when I'm finished with my clerkship as well. So, I'd like to be a criminal defense attorney someday.
Does it feel like in a weird way you've kind of attained like rock star status in the legal field?
Yeah, it's very strange to do everything backwards.
Yeah.
You know, getting the Supreme Court to grant a case, your case, is, kind of the pinnacle of everyone's legal career, and to have it happen before I even finish a bachelor's degree makes it a little strange at times.
Right. Yeah. It's like you already played in the, in the All-Star game, and then you go to law school and it's like back to the minors.
Yeah, it is. And, this summer I interned for the Federal Public Defender's Office here in Seattle, and it was really refreshing to get back to doing the work and actually helping people. That's why I enjoy the law, and you don't get to help many people in the midst of law school. So,
yeah, no, it's really an incredible story. Do you watch or have you seen any prison shows? Do you think they're accurate? There's a pretty popular one right now, and Orange is the New Black, but that's a woman's prison. I mean, do you see those shows and be like, oh, that's not what it's really like?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that any TV show can capture prison perfectly, because the biggest thing about prison is, for most of the days, there's nothing exciting happening. If you've ever seen the movie Groundhog Day, that's kind of what, like, federal prison is. Every day is about the same. The only thing that really separates the days are, you know, a sporting event on TV or somebody gets into a fight on the yard.
Oh, man, that's the excitement, huh?
That's the excitement. And other than that, it's a bunch of monotonous days where someone is telling you where to go and what to do most of the day.
How many prisoners did you write briefs for?
Oh, probably somewhere between 100 to 200.
Wow. So you were the go-to guy in there, huh?
I was busy. I had two people that would spend their days just typing for me.
I mean, well, it's actually
not typing for me. They would be typing for the prisoners I was helping.
It's very much like Shawshank Redemption, where Andy Dufresne has the accounting biz.
Yeah, very similar.
That's pretty amazing. And you're now living in Nebraska?
I'm living in Seattle.
Seattle, that's right. You're living in Seattle. So are you planning on staying in Washington or going back home, or what's your you like up there?
I don't know. You know, we're gonna, this time next year we will have moved across the country to Washington D.C. for the clerkship.
Yeah.
And you know, I could see us coming back to Washington. I could also see us moving to D.C. and never leaving. And the reason is, you know, I want to be involved with criminal justice and prison reform. And to have the type of impact that I want to have, it's not a bad idea to be located in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the hub. And you were just on. Were you just on 60 Minutes? Is that what I saw?
No, Inside Edition.
Inside Edition.
But I don't think they have aired the interview yet. Maybe sometime next week.
Well, we will look out for that. Before I let you go, I want to give you a chance to plug. You have a book.
I do. It's called Lawman, because the guys in prison used to say, "There goes my lawman." And the subtitle is My Story of Robbing Banks, Winning Supreme Court Cases, and Finding Redemption. And you can pick it up anywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and you know, all of the New York Times article and the NPR story has made the people at Random House very happy.
Yeah, well, I'll definitely pick up a copy, because I want to get all the, it's got all the nitty gritty on the bank robberies.
Oh, it's got the nitty gritty there, and what it's really like living in federal prison and trying to survive.
How much time do you have? I just want to ask one last question before I let you go. When you plan a bank robbery, is it literally like one of those things where you say, "Oh, we have 2 minutes to get in and out"?
Yeah. We tried to do it as quickly as possible, just because we wanted to get in and out without any problems.
Yeah. Wow.
It's so strange to talk about it now, because the guy you're talking to now would, you know, that's not even in the...
Right. It's not even you, really. I mean, it's not.
Does it feel like
it almost happened to a different person?
It does.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, it's incredible. I mean, it's really, you know, impressive. And, you know, I think it's admirable that, you know, you've gone on and, you know, looks like you have a bright future in the law. So we're all, you know, very happy to hear that and excited for what the future brings for you. And thank you so much for doing our podcast.
All right. Thanks, Matt.
I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, that was that interview. That was fascinating. And now, wow. Kev, of course.
That's a crazy story that guy's got.
It is. But now, your favorite part of the show, as always.
Yes.
Good cop, bad
cop. Good cop, bad cop.
Look, I'm really sorry about that. I just, I saw how aggressive you were being, and I thought, wow, I got to go even bigger than that since we're doing bad cop, bad cop.
What? No, I said good cop, bad cop. I'm the bad cop, you're the good cop.
Okay, then there it is. That's it. I thought you said bad cop, bad cop.
For those of you who don't know, who are just tuning in for the first time, good cop, bad cop, we go to our Twitter feed, we look to see how you're engaging with us, and we reward the people, particularly who've tweeted at us with the hashtag CALPOD, which stands for CalPod, and we send free T-shirts out to them. And I'm proud to say this week, again, we have many new followers. We have
lots of new followers.
Yeah, it looks like 14, 15 new followers only in the last week. However, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture because it doesn't look anyone really tweeted us. We got a retweet, though.
We did. We did get a retweet, which was nice. Larry Bodine retweeted our Comedians at Law new commercial, which if you haven't seen it, go to YouTube. Go to our YouTube page, Comedians at Law. We have our new law firm commercial. It's hysterical, and you definitely need to check it out.
Right. So Larry retweeted, but nobody tweeted at us, and I am – despite all my enthusiasm for our fan base, I have to say we can't send a free T-shirt this week. But I before you get too negative, I think you have to be very proud of the fact that people are reaching out to us on Twitter. They're following us.
They are following us. I would like to point out one of our newest followers, Sarah Dixon. Also, she goes by the handle at Sarah D Cutie. She's following us. I just happened to click over onto her Twitter page, and her most recent tweet of 6 hours ago was, "I really want to love somebody." Well, Sarah, you could love us by tweeting at us. We are ready for your love. We will take it in all forms. We are disease free, unlike the gentleman from Missouri, at least as far as we know. So tweet at us. It's safe. It's clean. It's risk free. And you get a T-shirt out of it, Sarah.
Right. Right. So
I'm gonna say, listen, nobody else can get a T-shirt, but if Sarah Dixon, just off of the random chance, listens to this and tweets at us, and tweets some love at us, we'll send you a T-shirt, Sarah.
I like that. I like that. I think that's great. That's a great way to end this segment because you almost came over from the dark side to the light.
I'm trying. You know, it's the summer's over. We're entering fall. Fall is one of my favorite seasons. I'm gonna try to be a little more positive.
All right. I like that. Yeah. All right. Well, look, we should wrap up the episode. People have to go. I have to do things. You have to do things. And most importantly, our listeners have to do things. So
yes. Remember, again, you can book us. You can book us for your school, for your shows, for your upcoming events. You probably got barrister balls coming up in the spring or some kind of bullshit nonsense going on. Do something more interesting than a happy hour. Bring Comedians at Law to your school. All the schools that have had us have loved us. You know, we're going back to a lot of the schools we've been booked at before. So get on the bandwagon.
Absolutely. And don't forget, October 4th, San Francisco at Cobb's Comedy Club. October 9th at the Stress Factory in New Jersey. And October 29th, if you're a lawyer in New Jersey, please do reach out to us at info@comediansatlaw.com because we'll be performing with the New Jersey Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts. All right, Kev, I think we're going to sign off.
All right, Alex. Everybody have a good night, and we'll talk to you next week.